Galatians 1, and it's verses 6 to 12 in particular that I want to focus on. We'll begin on. It says, I marvel that you are turning away so soon from him who called you in the grace of Christ to a different gospel, which is not another, but there are some who trouble you and want to pervert the gospel of Christ. But even if we, or an angel from heaven, preach any other gospel to you than what we have preached to you, let him be accursed. As we have said before, so now I say again, if anyone preaches any other gospel to you than what you have received, let him be accursed. For do I now persuade men or God, or do I seek to please men? For if I still pleased men, I would not be a bondservant of Christ. But I make known to you, brethren, that the gospel which was preached by me is not according to man. For I neither received it from man, nor was I taught it, but it came through the revelation of Jesus Christ. I wanted to start here in Galatians because I've been doing the witnessing to different groups, and this evening, as much as these verses also apply to Mormonism, if we think of Joseph Smith, claim that he got his revelation through an angel. This evening I want to take a look at Islam. And when we think of Islam, I wonder what first comes to our minds. Perhaps we think of terrorism, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Boko Haram, the Taliban. Or perhaps we think a mental picture of Muslims and the type of clothes they wear, the kind of white, long dresses, for want of a better word, and the hats and the prayer mats they use, or perhaps we think of the Quran, or Islamic countries like Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Iran, of oppressive governments towards women, towards non-Muslims, hostility towards the West, especially Israel. Perhaps we think of the Arabic language, or the symbol of the moon, or arranged marriages, honor killings, circumcision, female genital mutilation, Rochdale grooming gangs. Perhaps we think Sunni, Shia, Ahmadiyya, Sufi, which are denominations in Islam, or even key modern figures like Osama bin Laden, Saddam Hussein, Yasser Arafat, or politicians like Sadiq Khan, who's the mayor of London. Perhaps we think of large families, of Ramadan, of Sharia, of jihad, as well as Muhammad and Allah. And there is probably so much more that we could go on for this evening. And there are lots of different ways that we can approach Islam. And one of the problems I had in this message is I've tried to tackle each subject in one message, and this is going to be a two-parter, I'm sad to say, because I think it kind of needs it. It's easy to go into a lot of side points, and I will probably do that a little bit, that aren't necessarily important when we're speaking to Muslims. So, for example, it is true, according to the Islamic sources, that Muhammad married a six-year-old. It's true, according to the Islamic writings, that Muhammad advocated that his followers should drink camel urine. But these things are not necessarily the things that we should start with if we're looking to try to speak to Muslims. They aren't even the things that make Islam true or not. Like, Islam, the truth or the falsity of Islam doesn't stand or fall on whether or not people drink animal urine. In the 2011 census, the UK had 2.7 million Muslims. And 10 years later, in the 2021 census, this had risen to 3.9 million. The London Borough of Tower Hamlets now has over 40% Muslim population. In contrast, Christianity dropped from 59% to 46%, so 33.3 million to 27.5. And whilst, you know, we look at that 59% and that 46%, and the majority of those are not going to be true Christians, they're not going to be born-again believers, the statistics do paint a picture of the decline of Christianity and the rise of Islam, as well as other groups in the UK. One of the main reasons for this in the UK is birth rates, and the secondary or kind of joint main reason is immigration, but there is some conversion of non-Muslims to Islam as well. Whilst in one sense this should alarm us, I think it could also encourage us, because the Muslim world has largely been closed to missions when it comes to history. There's been a significant number of Muslims converting to Christianity in recent years. It's really hard to quantify, and different websites sometimes more sketchy when it comes to figures. I think it's hard to say. So whilst Christian missionaries are limited in their scope to be able to penetrate the Muslim world, we now have a situation where many people from around the world are coming here and coming to other European or Western nations, like the USA and others as well. There does seem to be, and it's anecdotal to a degree, people among that migrant or asylum seeker cohort that are actually open to hearing about the gospel. Now, I for one think that engaging Muslims in a spiritual conversation is actually much easier than engaging the majority of other people, because they come from a better starting point than the average British person. The majority of our nation are people that are agnostic or atheist, but the main reason for this is that they're actually apathetic. And so what I mean by that is, quite often they're just not interested. So they'll say, "I'm an atheist," just to kind of get away from the conversation, rather than it being a strong conviction. It's hard to speak to people about the gospel because they just don't really care, or they've closed themselves off, they dismiss attempts to engage them. Muslims, by and large, are not like this. They are very often passionate about being Muslim, and they start from a position of belief in the existence of a God and of one God. And I've often enjoyed conversations that I've had with Muslims in the past about spiritual things. Another thing that's important to know about Muslims is that Islam was born out of a very oral culture. So in the West, even historically, scholarship is quite prized, going all the way back to the Greeks, if you think of the writings of, you know, people like Plato and Aristotle and all of these sort of people. We've got a rich history, both religiously and unreligiously, of history and writings and philosophy and all of this sort of thing. And we've got a pretty good historical trail. Okay, it goes a little bit dark in some places, as we kind of noted last week with the Roman Catholics. But European history has largely been one of written history. But the culture that Muhammad lived in was very oral. Muhammad himself could not read or write, which is an amazing thought. And this is what the Muslim sources say about him. So they admit he couldn't read or write, which is crazy to think that he's the guy that allegedly gave us the Quran. And I don't know if anyone here has ever read it. It does read a little bit like someone who couldn't read or write came up with it. It's really difficult to follow. There's not really a logical train of thought. Anyway, I kind of digress. I haven't read the whole thing. I started and really just could not continue with it. So whilst, you know, we can hand out like books and tracts and things like that, that's not necessarily the best way to engage Muslims, particularly Muslims from other parts of the world. I've been to Speaker's Corner in London a few times. There's always a lot of Muslims there. There's other groups there as well, but the Muslims are always very loud and they talk very fast. They like verbal sparring rather than kind of sitting down and reading and studying. And I know that's a generalization and that there will be Muslims that read and write and are scholarly, but kind of on a ground level, when it comes to engaging with religion and things like that, they like a conversation rather than kind of a written presentation. In more modern times, this is carried over to platforms like YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, where there's a lot of apologetics and debates and that sort of thing that can be found on those platforms. When you get in group settings, this can sometimes get worse. You've perhaps seen footage before of large groups of Muslims kind of marching along, shouting things like Allahu Akbar or words to that effect and things like that. So this evening I want to focus mainly on the history of Islam as it is kind of given at the moment, and we'll look at a few scriptures as well as we go through, and then next week we'll look more at some of the beliefs and engage in them, what sort of questions to ask and things like that. Now, Islam originated with Muhammad, who lived from 570 to 632 BC in modern day Saudi Arabia, but there is something that's called the standard Islamic narrative. And we're going to follow that because that's what Muslims believe. And I say standard Islamic narrative because as more history is unearthed and as historians, both Christian and secular, have done digging around certain things, there's an increasing amount of evidence that sort of points towards the conclusion that Muhammad did not actually exist. So there's a guy called Jay Smith. He's a Christian apologist and he's one of the leading scholars in the world on Islam, and he's adamant that Muhammad did not exist. Now, not every Islamic apologist, as in Christian apologist to Islam, would share that view, but there are things that are coming out that kind of make you think it almost couldn't be. There's a secular historian called Tom Holland, not the Hollywood actor that plays Spider-Man. He's an atheist, but he has written lots of books on, he studied world empires, so he's written on the Romans, the Persians, and he studied the Arabic Empire, and he came to the conclusion that Islam did not birth the Arabic Empire, but the Arabic Empire birthed Islam, and they kind of backdated some of their history. So, for example, there is no record of Mecca existing in the 7th century when Islam was supposedly began and Muhammad was alive. There's not record of trade routes that went through that part of Arabia. Their trade routes actually went up the Red Sea along the coast of Africa where there was population. In Arabia at the time, you just had travelling groups of Bedouin, which are the kind of nomadic groups of people. There weren't major cities. The historical records suggest that there weren't large cities of population. As well as this, the way that the Quran describes Mecca is completely inaccurate to what Mecca is today or what Mecca would have been historically. For example, the Quran describes the city, and it doesn't necessarily name it, it'll just describe the city that Muhammad was born in as a city with lots of olive trees. Olive trees do not grow anywhere near Mecca. They grow in southern Israel and southern Jordan, but they don't grow in Saudi Arabia, or that part of Saudi Arabia at least. The description of the land is very fertile and agricultural. Mecca's in the middle of a desert. But archaeology shows that in the Negev Desert, which is southern Israel and that part of the world, southern Jordan too, they were once all fertile farmland with complex irrigation systems. And so what you do is when you actually look at what the Quran says about Mecca and you compare it to Mecca, it doesn't line up. But when you compare it to cities in southern Israel or southern Jordan, they actually fit the description of the agriculture and the kind of plants and things like that. Now, the Bible doesn't have that problem with, because when the Bible names something and describes something and you go and look, it's as the Bible said. But in this case, there's a lot of reason to kind of cast doubt upon the standard Islamic narrative of history. But we'll carry on through with that because that's what most Muslims believe. So most Muslims believe that Muhammad was born in Mecca, that he lived there, his father died before he was born, and his mother died when he was young, and he was eventually raised by his uncle, and at 25 married a witch widow called Khadija, who was 40 at the time. And this kind of set him up for life. And so during this time, he started going to this cave to pray. And in this cave, he saw visions of the angel Gabriel, who revealed to him the Quran. The Quran is the word of Allah. Now, Allah is actually a Nabataean moon god. The Nabataeans lived in southern Jordan, which again kind of lines up with the description of the land that comes out of the Quran. Allah was originally part of a pantheon, so a group of several gods, and the Nabataeans lived in Petra. Petra is nearly 1,500 miles north of Mecca as the bird flies. So how did the Nabataean moon god move 1,500 miles south and end up being the god that allegedly revealed himself to Muhammad in Mecca. That's unclear, unless actually perhaps this was happening somewhere else and the Islamic history is not true. But not only this, Allah in the Nabataean pantheon had a wife and two daughters. They are called Alat, Al-Uzza and Manat. And these names make it into the Quran in what is called the Satanic Verses. So in other words, Muhammad, including three pagan goddesses as part of his family, these three pagan goddesses as part of Allah's family in the Quran. But then he claims that he wrote down the verses under the suggestion of Satan. So they believe that some of the Quran Muhammad wrote under the inspiration of Satan, but the rest of it is the word of Allah. Which really begs the question, how can you trust any of the Quran if the Quran itself admits that part of it was sourced by Satan? And that's one of the things that as we've gone through and you look at what some of the cults believe, you think, like, how on earth?
Is that where Salman Rushdie got the...
Yeah, because he was stabbed a few years ago. Yeah, that's what inspired his book, and he wrote about, went into some of that, because I think he's an ex-Muslim. I don't think he's necessarily a Christian, but yeah, he's an ex-Muslim that exposed things about Islam. It's a very proud religion that Muslims do not like being mocked, and so I think because he exposed it, it was embarrassing for them, and so the response is violence often. As we read, Galatians 6:8 says, "But even if we or an angel from heaven preach any other gospel to you than what we have preached, let him be accursed." We're allegedly having visions in a cave of a different gospel, a new gospel that contradicts the Bible. According to scripture, according to the Apostle Paul, Muhammad should be accursed. Which is interesting because, and we'll probably get to this more next week, the Quran itself tells Muslims to go to the people of the book, meaning the Bible, and learn from them that the book is also the word of Allah. It's so self-contradictory. Muhammad was initially rejected in Mecca, so moved to Medina with a small group of followers. Shortly after that, the city converted to Islam, he became its leader, and he started to subdue the surrounding areas. And it was a case of submit or die. And that's what Islam means. Islam means submission, and a Muslim means one who submits. He apparently received more revelation in Medina, so it wasn't just in this cave, he received later on. And this gave birth to a key idea in Islam, that of abrogation. The idea that new revelation supersedes or is more important than older revelation. So the Quran is allowed to contradict itself, but you go with what's latest, which is one way they kind of get around the contradictions. But we don't have that problem, right? In Christianity, the new never abrogates the old. The old actually always tests the new, right? If we're looking at new revelation, does it line up with what's already revealed? Rather than, hey, here's some new revelation, it doesn't line up, so let's cancel the old stuff. Because otherwise, if you've got abrogation, you can just make it up as you go along compared to what's convenient to you at the time. But scripture doesn't work like that. The New Testament revealed some things that were new. It revealed things that weren't in the old, but it didn't reveal anything that contradicted the old or anything that kind of changed or reinterpreted the old. Muhammad was 52 when he moved to Medina, 54 when he started to fight the places around him. The first major battle was 2 years after he moved to Medina, and within 6 more years, he had conquered Mecca. He died 2 years after this, poisoned by a Jewish woman that he had taken captive. And Muhammad's first wife died 2 years before he moved to Medina, and he married 9 other women after this, including Aisha, who was his favourite wife, the one that was 6 years old. There are Islamic historical sources that record Muhammad in his late years wearing the clothes of his child bride, and when he did so, there are verses that say Muhammad received revelation from Allah whilst wearing. So in other words, this is a sort of embarrassing episode that forms part of Islamic history. Now, do I think we should go up to Muslims and say, did you know that in 6 places in the Hadiths, and the Hadiths are the historical writings that go alongside them, do you know in 6 different places in the Hadiths it says that Muhammad wore the dress of Aisha? No, I don't think that's necessarily the best place to start. But I do think that there is a place for questioning Islamic history and maybe asking this sort of question down the line. Like, what do you think about this that's in the Hadith? In a gentle or a respectful way. We don't go in with a, let's like make fun of you straight away. You know, we can ask Muslims things, especially once a little bit of a connection's been made. Do you really believe that Islam should be spread by the sword or spread by jihad? Do you agree with that? Because that's what your history says, that Muhammad was able to spread Islam by. Do you believe that Muhammad had flaws and mistakes? That's a good question to ask. You can ask them what they think about polygamy and child marriages, or ask them about the satanic verses, or about slavery and things like this. So these things are useful to know in the right context. I don't think that they should necessarily be the thing that we bring up when we first speak to them, though. And I say in the right context because other people, and Muslims included, will ask us those type of questions, right? Why did God tell the Israelites to wipe out cities in the Canaan conquest? Doesn't the Bible condone slavery, especially in the Old Testament? Isn't the God of the Old Testament violent and vengeful? Or didn't God allow incest at certain times between like Abraham and Sarah? What was going on in Numbers 5 with the test of purity? And there are some questions that we can sometimes find difficult to answer ourselves. And so we shouldn't be afraid to be sometimes polemical in our evangelism and be sometimes on the front foot and ask the difficult questions back. We can still do so in a respectful way. After Muhammad died, there was a power struggle. Sunnis, and this is where the Sunni-Shia divide comes from, Sunnis followed a guy called Abu Bakr, and the Shias backed Muhammad's relative Ibn Ali Talib. Abu Bakr came out on top, and then he was followed by a guy called Umar, and then a guy called Uthman. And by the time Muhammad died, they pretty much controlled the Arabian Peninsula, most of modern-day Saudi Arabia, as well as Oman and Yemen at the bottom. Under Abu Bakr, Umar, and Uthman, which was over the next 30 years or more, the first Islamic caliphate extended from Persia or Iran in the east to Libya in the west. So it wasn't the whole of Egypt and Libya, but the northern parts of those countries they were able to subdue. Also made its first inroads into the southern part of modern Turkey and controlled the Middle East, what's called the Levant. Over the next 90 years after Uthman, this extended from modern-day Pakistan across the whole of North Africa and controlled the majority of Spain and all of Portugal. Over the next few centuries, it spread further over northern India and basically was from China to southern France at one point, including all the way up into Turkey further. They attempted to invade France but were defeated at the Battle of Tours by a guy called Charles Martel. And then later in history, the Ottoman Empire held much territory in Eastern Europe, including Hungary and Greece. In the early ones, also Sicily and part of southern Italy at some point came under Muslim control. And so it was partially because of the front-foot, very aggressive caliphates that were trying to spread their empires. Partially this inspired the medieval crusades. This was all going on 700s, 800s, 900s. The first crusade was 10-something or other, 91 maybe. And so whilst they weren't necessarily defensive, I think there was a defensive aspect to them in some way. Europe was under real pressure from these early Islamic empires and pushed back. But going to the death of Muhammad and the rise of his successors in particular, I want to focus on Uthman just for a minute. He was the third caliph, so Abu Bakr, Umar, Uthman. He ordered that all the copies of the Quran that were in circulation at the time be brought to him. They brought him 7 complete Qurans. They were all different to each other. He burned 6 of them and kept just 1 because they were much different to each other. So he basically picked the one that he liked best and burned the rest. And this is important when it comes to Muslim beliefs about the Quran, because they believe the Quran is eternal in heaven, it's unchanged, and the version we have on earth is exactly like the version in heaven. But the problem is, even though this guy burned all the other ones, even today you have over 30 different Arabic Qurans that are different to each other in different places of the world. And they don't know which one is the real one, which is, that's a good place to start with them. Now when it comes to Muhammad, Muslims believe that Muhammad is the latest and the greatest prophet, that no prophet will ever arise again, except perhaps the last imam or the last Mahdi, though it's unclear if this figure is a prophet. They believe in many previous prophets, such as Moses, Jesus, etc., but they believe that Muhammad is greater than them all. That's one of the reasons we sang, "Jesus shall take the highest honour this evening." Muslims believe that the Bible prophesied the coming of Muhammad. I don't know if you know that. Deuteronomy 18, verses 15 to 22. One of the other reasons we sang the other songs we did was because in I Cannot Tell, it speaks about the Lord, East and West, bringing people in. And Lord for the years, praise for the whole of the earth. But Deuteronomy 18, 15 to 22. The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your midst, from your brethren. Him you shall hear, according to all you desired of the Lord your God in Horeb, in the day of the assembly, saying, "Let me not hear again the voice of the Lord my God, nor let me see this great fire any more, lest I die." And the Lord said to me, "What they have spoken is good. I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among the brethren, and will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. And it shall be that whoever will not hear my words, which he speaks in my name, I will require it of him. But the prophet who presumes to speak a word in my name, which I have not commanded him to speak, or who speaks in the name of other gods, that prophet shall die. And if you say in your heart, 'How shall we know the word which the Lord has not spoken?' When a prophet speaks in the name of the Lord, if the thing does not happen or come to pass, that is the thing which the Lord has not spoken. The prophet has spoken it presumptuously. You shall not be afraid of him." And the passage really gives us two things. It gives us a prophecy of a future coming prophet and a test by which to identify true and false prophets. Muhammad taught in the Quran, for example, that Miriam, the sister of Moses and Aaron, was the same Miriam or Mary that was also the wife of Joseph and the mother of Jesus. Now, granted, it wasn't a prediction per se. The Quran doesn't really have predictions. But basic, simple mistakes like this are not the mistakes that someone who is a true prophet makes. We notice in verse 15 and also verse 18, Moses told the children of Israel that the prophet like him who would rise up would be from among their brethren. In other words, the prophet would be Jewish. Muhammad was an Arab, so it cannot apply to Muhammad. Muhammad fails to test on both counts. He's not from among the brethren, nor is he a true prophet either. But what actually is the case is if you look at the life of Moses and the career of Moses, and you look at Jesus from certain perspectives, you see so much that lines up. As well as this, I've read some books that view Mark's gospel as a spiritual exodus, that actually a lot of the things that happened in the exodus get repeated, that there's kind of typology and carryover in Mark's gospel. So, for example, you have the wilderness wanderings, and then you have Jesus. He also goes into the wilderness for 40 days and for 40 nights, just like the Israelites were there for 40 years. You have Jesus kind of doing things that points back to how Moses led the children of Israel as well. Even the miracles that Jesus did line up at times to some of the miracles that Moses did as well. Moses, for example, turned the rivers of Egypt and the waters of Egypt into blood. Jesus, in his first miracle, okay, it wasn't blood, but there's similarity between the miracles of the Messiah and the miracles of Moses. Moses was, in essence, a Messiah figure rescuing the people from bondage. We've looked at the Passover before and how that points to Jesus. So there's so much that lines up between the two figures. Obviously not perfect, because there's no such thing as a perfect type of Christ. But Moses, in lots of ways, was a type of Christ. But there's nothing that lines up between Moses and Muhammad. Jesus is like Moses. He's greater than Moses. In fact, the book of Hebrews argues that Jesus is greater than Moses, but there's no similarity between Moses and Muhammad. If we could turn to John 14, verses 16 to 17, this is another passage that Muslims point to say that the Bible predicts the coming of Muhammad. They'll say, "Jesus said that he was going to send Muhammad." and I will pray the Father, and he will give you another helper, that he may abide with you forever. The Spirit of truth, whom the world cannot receive, because it neither sees him nor knows him. But you know him, for he dwells with you and will be in you. So the belief here that this speaks of Muhammad not only contradicts the text, but contradicts Islamic belief. So they believe that Muhammad is the greatest prophet. They believe that at the end, Muhammad sends Jesus back. But here, Jesus is sending, in their view, Muhammad, which would almost make Jesus greater than Muhammad in their kind of logical mindset. The problem is as well, Muslims believe the word comforter, translated into Arabic, is Ahmed, which means praised one, and so therefore they think that the comforter is Muhammad. And yet the text says, for he dwells with you, present tense, and shall be in you, future tense. Now, I'm not sure how Muhammad dwelt with the disciples of Jesus, nor am I sure how Muslims believe he dwells in the disciples of Jesus. These statements are impossible for any human being, okay? They're impossible for Muhammad. The phrase another comforter in particular is important, particularly the word another, because it means another of the same kind. Jesus, being God in human flesh on earth, sends someone to be the comforter who is also God ministering on earth. And there's only one person that can be present with them and then dwelling inside them, and that's God the Holy Spirit. And Muhammad also doesn't dwell with his people forever. For it says here, but you know him, for he dwells with you and will be in you. Really difficult for the disciples to know someone who wouldn't be born for another 1200 years. It's just not feasible that this could be speaking about Muhammad. But they're the two go-to texts to say, look, the Bible prophesied Muhammad, the Quran, like, kind of supplements onto the end of. And I want to touch on one more thing this evening from a kind of apologetical perspective before I close, and that is talk just for a little bit about slavery and the slave trade in Islam. The Muslim world has a much bigger and longer history when it comes to trading in slaves than the Western world ever did. Slavery is still a big issue in the Western world. Like, even in our government, there's been talk of reparations and things like that, which in many ways is a joke, because if you pay reparations for that, you then have to look at everything and every offence against every group, and where does it stop? During the slave trade, more slaves went into the Muslim world than were ever transported by Europeans to the New World. Many times, even in Cornwall, Devon, Dorset and other parts of the UK and Europe, were raided by Barbary pirates from the Islamic world. And this occurred between roughly 1530 and 1780, well, and beyond. But in that period, it's estimated that 1.25 million white Christians from Europe were abducted into slavery by the Islamic Barbary pirates. And it was eventually the American Navy in the early 1800s that put a stop to it. The American Marines have their own kind of national anthem. It includes a line in the first line to the coast, or to the port of Tripoli, because one of the first wars that the Americans fought was against Tripoli in North Africa, and they defeated the Barbary pirates. But when it comes to slavery, in particularly African slavery, Islam has a big problem because, and I'm going to just read some verses from the Hadiths. The Hadiths are, they're kind of like the early church fathers, but also kind of a bit like Josephus, but also a bit like commentaries on the Quran. I don't know how else to explain them other than that, but they are not the Quran itself, but some Muslims hold them to be completely authentic. And they're a little bit like the Apocrypha. So it's a mix of all those things. That's kind of what the Hadiths are. But from the Hadith Sahih al-Bukhari 63, there was this account. This guy comes along. He says, who amongst you is Muhammad? At the time the Prophet was sitting amongst us, leaning on his arm, we replied, the white man reclining on his arm. Another part of the Hadith Sahih Muslim 61 says, it was narrated that Abu Jahifa said, I saw the Messenger of Allah with a white complexion and some white hairs. And I say this because there are lots of places in the Hadith where it describes Muhammad as having white coloured skin. It never describes him as being dark. We perhaps picture a dark Middle Eastern person, but the descriptions of him are that he was white. And there's one place where one of his companions says, anyone that says that he's a dark-skinned person will be slain. Now, the hadiths also say this. Sahih al-Bukhari 7263 says, narrated by Umar, which was the second caliph, I went to the house of the Prophet, and behold, Allah's Messenger was staying in Mashruba, which is an attic room, and a black slave of Allah's Messenger was at the top of the stairs. So Muhammad owned black slaves. Sahih al-Bukhari 6161 says, Allah's Messenger was on a journey and he had a black slave called Anjasha. And one more, Ibn Asik, page 243 says, the Prophet said, whoever wants to see Satan, let him take a look at Mabtal Bal Harith. He was a sturdy black man with long flowing hair, inflamed eyes, dark ruddy cheeks. So Muhammad said, if you want to know what Satan looks like, look at the black slave that I have over there. Now, Arabs are actually Caucasian, more closely related to European than they are to Asians or Africans. And due in part to figures such as Malcolm X, Islam has been able to portray itself as the religion of black liberation and portray Christianity as the religion of white imperialism and colonialism. And yet the fact of the matter is that Muhammad bought and sold African slaves according to the hadiths. And then he said, if you want to look to see what Satan looks like, look at a black African person. The Arab empires were the ones to standardize the African slave trade centuries before the Europeans got involved. When we arrived, it was already a thing that was going on and we jumped on the bandwagon. I'm not saying that we were right to do so by any means, but European nations got involved centuries after Islam had started it, and it carried on for centuries after the European nations abolished it. Legal chattel slavery of Africans was only legally abolished in Muslim Middle Eastern countries like Saudi Arabia, Dubai and Oman in the 1960s. And only through the pressure by Western powers and the United Nations did they do that. And I just want to end on this quote. In April 1998, Alikia Mbakolo wrote in Le Monde Diplomatique, the African continent was bled of its human resources via all possible routes. Across the Sahara, through the Red Sea, from the Indian Ocean ports and across the Atlantic. So that's both directions. At least 10 centuries of slavery for the benefit of the Muslim country from the 9th century. He continues, 4 million slaves exported via the Red Sea, another 4 million through the Swahili ports of the Indian Ocean, perhaps as many as 9 million along the Trans-Saharan caravan route, and 11 to 20 million, depending on the author, across the Atlantic Ocean. So the point being there is that when we think of the slave trade, we think of ships leaving England, going to the Ivory Coast and Western Africa, sailing across the Atlantic, and then going back to the triangle trade. But actually, more went east than they ever went west. You know, slavery is something that is an issue, and something that in some ways Christianity has to answer for in terms of people that misused the Bible in the past to try to justify things, or people that simply lived in countries that were considered Christian but were never 100% Christian. Whereas the Islamic world condones and promotes slavery. And people say there's still more slaves in the world today than at any point in history. And if you want to know where they live, the majority of them end up in Muslim countries. So I'm going to end there, because that was a little bit of an apologetical or polemical note. Next week we will focus on some of the key core beliefs and some of the questions that we can do to kind of engage them.